Okay, so last time we talked about weak freeze-outs. So then today I wanted to talk about something that's related, a process happening at basically the same time, which is called Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Okay, so this just means the formation of nuclei back in the early universe. Nucleosynthesis. Okay, so this is obviously an important process because we are made out of, well, atoms that have nuclei. Okay, so just to put this in context, you know, so back in the early universe, as we said, the universe is very hot, very dense. So therefore, lots of nuclear reactions were taking place very frequently, right? So, yeah, so a hot, dense universe, you would think would correspond to a high nuclear reaction rate. Okay, so because the reaction rate was so high, then you might think that all of the nuclei, I mean, you know, all of the nucleons would then fuse together via fusion processes to make the most bound nuclei, things like iron, for example, right? Okay, so yeah, so naively you would expect lots and lots of, things like iron 56. Okay, but actually what happens is that, you know, what we get from the early universe is mostly just hydrogen and helium. That's terrible. Okay, and the reason for this discrepancy between what actually happens and what you might naively expect, okay, the reason for that will turn out to be just the enormous number of photons compared to the number of nucleons. Okay, so to get started, let's recall that weak interactions can convert protons and neutrons into each other. Okay, so for example, you can have processes like, you know, a proton, an electron can combine to make a neutron and then also an electron neutrino. Now, before weak freeze-out, these sort of weak interactions were taking place very frequently. And so therefore, the abundances of protons and neutrons were therefore in equilibrium with each other with the same temperature as the photons. Okay, so around the time of weak freeze-out, both neutrons and protons are both non-relativistic. Okay, and if we recall our expressions for the non-relativistic abundance, okay, you know, that abundance depends on things like the rest mass, the temperature, the, you know, the G's, you know, the, you know, the number of internal degrees of freedom and so on. Okay. Now, because both neutrons and protons are both spin half particles and their masses are very similar to each other, okay, this means that they have similar abundances, okay, and the ratio of their abundances, the number density of neutrons compared to the number density of protons, okay, this ratio is basically just set by the mass difference, okay? So, you know, something like e to the minus delta m compared to t freeze out, where this delta m is just the mass difference between the proton and the neutron. So delta m is just mn minus m proton, which is around 1.3 electron volts, I mean MeV. Okay? And so if, let's say, weak freeze-out happens at, you know, let's say 0.8 MeV, okay, we would then expect then that this ratio of neutrons to protons to be something like, you know, e to the minus 1.3 over 0.8, so around 0.2, okay? So therefore, at the time of weak freeze-out, you know, we would expect something like 5 protons for every neutron. That's at this one time. As a function of time, you know, so if we plot this ratio, number of neutrons versus number of protons, as a function of time going this way, you know, as temperature going this way, you know, so for high temperatures, that ratio is almost constant. And then once we start reaching temperatures around this mass ratio, then this number ratio then starts falling off a cliff, okay? However, though, it stops once we hit weak freeze-out, which happens somewhere around here, okay, when this ratio is around 1 to 5, and after that, then it stays relatively flat for a bit of time, okay? At least that would be our naive expectation, right? Does that make sense, what I'm saying? Okay, good. So, okay, good. So therefore, then you might think that this number then would just stay constant forever. However, though, there is one extra process that occurs that can change this ratio on timescales even after this nominal weak freezeout. Do you guys have any guesses for what might change this number of neutrons compared to protons? So if I start with some box of neutrons in this room, what'll happen? Oh, yeah, well, so that'll happen later. Neglecting nuclear fusion processes. If I just have like some box of neutrons, like today, and then I just leave the box overnight and come back tomorrow, will it be there tomorrow?
Decay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so free decay of neutrons happens. Do you guys know the time scale for that? It's around like 15 minutes or so, okay? So therefore, eventually on the free decay timescale, again, this will also plummet, okay? And so therefore, since our universe is much, much older than 15 minutes, you might therefore think that this number of neutrons will just go to zero back in the early universe. But it doesn't, because other things also happen before that, which are, as you were saying, nuclear fusion processes, okay? Right, so there are nuclear processes that can occur even after weak freeze out, okay? So what that means is that there are nuclear processes that can happen that don't involve converting neutrons to protons or vice versa. They don't involve neutrinos necessarily. So an example of this is like the fusion of a proton and a neutron to make a deuteron. A deuterium is just an isotope of hydrogen that has atomic number of 2, 1 neutron and 1 proton. And then to conserve energy, you have to have also a photon radiated away. Another example is like, two deuterons can fuse together to make a helium-3 nucleus and also a neutron coming out, okay? So these sort of interactions, these sort of processes, they can stay in equilibrium for a while, even after weak interactions have frozen out, okay? And so because they stay continuing for a while, okay, these sort of interactions preserve thermal equilibrium of protons and neutrons with each other, along with the other heavy nuclei, okay? So because equilibrium is preserved, we can write down expressions for the abundances of all of these species, neutrons, protons, even heavier nuclei, okay? So for example, the number density of some, of some nucleus with atomic number A, call it NA, it's just the same expression that we had before, okay? So it's G for that A, MA times T over 2 pi to the 3 halves, and then E to the mu A minus MA over T. Okay, the same thing we had before, okay? So that's the equilibrium abundance for some species with atomic number A. Very similar expressions will also hold true for the protons and also for the neutrons, okay? And so now what we'll do is to use these expressions then to figure out how many neutrons, how many protons, how many nuclei with A will occur as a function of time, or equivalently as a function of temperature, okay? And so the way that we'll do that is to use the relations between these chemical potentials, okay? So, for example, okay, some nucleus that has atomic number A, composed out of, let's say, Z protons and then a corresponding number of neutrons. Okay, so it'll be made out of, Z protons and then A minus Z neutrons. Okay, this implies then that the chemical potential for species A is related to the chemical potentials for protons and for neutrons. And so do you guys know the relation? We discussed it before. So how is mu A related to mu for protons and mu for neutrons?
Sum of chemical potentials of these interacting should be the same.
Exactly. Good. So what are the reactants here?
Reactants here are P and N.
P and N. How many P's do I have?
One.
Okay. Well, I have Z. Okay, so then how are the chemical potentials related?
Z mu P plus.
Okay, good. So now what I'll do is to divide both sides by temperature. And then I will, and so then next I will then exponentiate both sides. Okay, so let me just make some more room. Okay, so therefore E to the mu A over T is equal to, well, E to the right-hand side, all of this, okay? So E to all of this, which I'll write as E to the this times E to the this, okay? And then I'll write this as E to the mu P over T, all of that raised to the Z power, and so, okay? And similarly for that side. Okay, so that's E to the mu proton over temperature, all of this raised to the Z power, multiplied by E to the mu neutron over T, all of this raised to the A minus Z power. Okay, so far are you with me? Okay, the next thing that I'll do now is to take our equilibrium expression for our species, okay? So for the protons, for example, okay? Right, so for protons, you know, the same expression holds true. We just replace all the A's by P's. And then I'll move everything except for E to the mu P over T over to the other side. Okay, and so I'll write E to the mu P over T in terms of the number density of protons. Okay, and then similarly for neutrons. And then I'll take that to the Z power for the protons, take that to the A minus Z power for the neutrons. Okay, therefore giving me a complicated expression for E to the mu A over T, involving the number density of neutrons, the number density of protons. You follow what I'm doing here? Okay, and then I will then insert that into my expression for the number density of species A, okay? Because we have this E to the mu A over T, okay? So if we do all of that, okay, so of course there's lots of algebra going on, which gives me messy expressions. I will spare you most of it, but just to give you a sense, I will write down one of the messy expressions. Okay, so what we get is that the number density of species A looks something like GA over 2 to the A. Okay, so number 2, not Z. MAT over 2 pi, all to the 3 halves. Okay, then I'll write M nucleon T over 2 pi to the minus 3A over 2. Okay, number density of protons raised to the Z power, number density of neutrons raised to the A minus Z power, and then E to a big mess, which is ZMP plus A minus ZM neutron minus MA, all of this divided by T. Okay? Here, this M capital N, I'm writing as the mass of nucleons, okay? So I am distinguishing between the proton mass and the neutron mass here in the exponent, but I'm not distinguishing outside the exponent. Okay, does that make sense? Good. So since I'm not distinguishing between protons and neutrons outside the exponent, I can also therefore approximate this MA as just A times M nucleon. Okay, so here I will just replace MA by A times M nucleon. Okay, now inside the exponent I have this complicated combination of the masses, okay? And then you might recognize this complicated combination of the masses as just the binding energy of species A, right? These are all the things that went into making that nucleus. This is the mass of that nucleus. The difference is the binding energy of that nucleus. Okay, so all of this I will write as the binding energy of species A. Okay, so the number density then works out to, it's a mess. Okay, so yeah, GA over 2 to the A to the 3 halves, the mass of nucleons times temperature over 2 pi, all that to the 3 halves 1 minus A. Number density of protons to the Z, number density of neutrons to the A minus Z, and then E to the binding energy over temperature. Okay, we're almost there. The next thing that I'll do now is to define the mass fraction in species A. Okay, so let's define a quantity called capital X, the mass fraction of all nucleons that are in the form of species A. Okay, so it's equal to the number density of species A times the number of nucleons in species A divided by the total number of all nucleons. Okay? And so we'll do that for species A and also for the protons and also for the neutrons. Okay? So this number of all nucleons, okay, is just equal to the number of protons plus the number of neutrons plus a sum over all possible other nuclei, okay, of, you know, each of their A times NA. Okay? And so therefore, then by definition, the sum over all of these X's has to sum to 1. Okay, so sum over I of A, of XI, by definition, is 1. Okay? With the sum also includes protons and also includes neutrons. Okay, so if we plug in this definition into our expression for the number density of species A, we can then write down an expression for the mass fraction in species A. Right. I guess I'll also write it out. Okay, so what we get is that the mass fraction in species A is again this, g over 2 to the 8th power, a to the 5 halves, number density of all nucleons raised to the a minus 1, mass of nucleons temperature over 2 pi, all of this to the 3 halves 1 minus a, mass fraction of protons to the z, mass fraction of neutrons to the a minus z, and then again e to the binding energy over temperature. Okay, the final step now that I'll do is to write this number of nucleons in terms of the number of photons. Okay, so we'll write the number of nucleons as the number of photons multiplied by this quantity eta that we wrote down before, you know, the number of baryons per photon. Okay, so if you recall, this eta is a super tiny number. It's, so something like 1 over 2 billion. Okay, so something like, 5 times 10 to the minus 10. And the number of photons, of course, is related to the temperature of the photons. Okay, so to remind you, the number of photons is the following expression, 2 times the Riemann zeta function, evaluated at 3, divided by 2 pi squared. Times t cubed, okay? So then all I'll do now, is to replace this number with this product, eta times number of photons, okay? Again, gives a long expression. Maybe I'll skip the whole thing. What we find in the end is that this scales, okay, well, the important terms are temperature over nucleon mass raised to the 3 halves, a minus 1, mass fraction of protons to the z, mass fraction of neutrons to the a minus z, baryon to photon ratio to the a minus 1, and then finally e to the binding temperature over a. Okay, so this looks like a horrible expression. But the important factors here that I want you to focus on are these following, the final two factors in this whole expression, okay? So first we have this eta, the baryon to photon number, raised to some potentially large power, okay? So for large nuclei like helium or like iron, this can be like, you know, this can be like 55 or something, okay? And also then we have this binding energy compared to the temperature exponentiated, okay? So what'll happen is that these two terms will be competing with each other to determine the overall abundance of that species, okay? So heuristically, the way to think about this is that this term tells you which of these nuclei will be energetically favored. This term tells you which of these nuclei will be entropically favored, okay? The way to think about this is that this eta is telling you how many photons there are for every nucleon, right? So, for example, this eta to the minus one, or say one over eta, this is the number of photons per baryon, and again, this is a huge number, something like 2 × 10⁹. Okay, so think of this one over eta as like the entropy per baryon, okay? So having the entropy be so large means that it disfavors having large nuclei, okay? You know, so for large entropy per nucleon, the nucleons will favor being in many, many small nuclei as opposed to a small number of large nuclei. Does that make sense? Okay. Competing with that will be this binding energy term, right? Okay, the more bound the nucleus is, the more favored it will be, especially at low temperatures. Okay, so to see which of these terms wins, let's just write down some of the binding energies for various different species. Okay, so here, let's just make a table of some examples of species and their binding energies. Okay, so an example, we have deuterium, which is, you know, just hydrogen. Heavy hydrogen. We'll also have helium-4, and let's say carbon-12. Okay, so the binding energy of deuterium per nucleon is something like 2.2 mega electron volts. Oh no, sorry, this is not per nucleon. This is in total. For helium-4, it's 28 mega electron volts, and for carbon-12, it's 92 mega electron volts. Okay, so now let's see which of these two terms is going to win at different temperatures. Okay, so at weak freeze-out, okay, the temperature again is around 1 MeV. Okay, so for deuterium, okay, with A equals 2, this entropic factor of eta to the A minus 1 works out to eta to the 1, right? Okay, so eta to the 1. As we said, is around 10⁻⁹. Okay, the other term is binding energy will be e to the 2.2 compared to 1, so therefore e to the 2.2, right? E to the 2 or 3 is some number like around 5 or 10 or something. Okay, so the other term, e to the b over t, will be something like, I don't know, call it 10. Okay, so which of these wins? I mean, this clearly wins, right? So therefore, at 1 MeV temperatures, there's basically no deuterium. Does that make sense? Okay? Okay, deuterium. Okay, so now let's say helium. Okay, so helium is A equals 4, giving us eta to the 3. Okay, so we cube this, getting 10 to the minus, I don't know, 27, 28, something like that. Okay. E to the b over t is e to the 28. So 10 to the minus 28 versus e to the 28. What wins? 10 to the minus 28 versus e to the 28.
10 to the minus.
Yeah, right? So no helium. Okay, carbon, we can do the same thing. Okay, eta to the 11th versus e to the 92. Again, there's no carbon. Okay, so therefore, at 1 MeV temperatures, there's basically no nuclei at all, just free protons and free neutrons. Okay, and again, the reason for that is this enormous entropy, the enormous number of photons for every baryon. Okay, now for comparison, in astrophysics, there are other environments where these sort of nuclear processes can occur that have lower entropies. Okay, there have to be because, well, we exist, right? You know, we're not just like, you know, protons and neutrons, right? So there are environments that can make heavier elements. So for example, type 1a supernovae, okay? So inside a type 1a supernova, the typical entropy, so that is like the typical number of photons for a baryon is order one, okay? So, therefore, inside a supernovae, it is possible to have nuclear fusion reactions burning all the way up to the most bound nuclei, things like iron 56, okay? And that's why we think that most of the iron that we see here on the Earth, out in space, most of that came from things like supernovae, okay? It does not occur, however, in the early universe, as we'll see in a moment. Okay, good. So all of this was for a 1 MeV temperature, okay? But as we know, the universe is expanding, the temperature is always cooling down. So therefore, later times, what happens? Okay, so for example, if we lower the temperature, you know, by a factor of, let's say, 3 or 10, okay, you know, you can see then that eventually this binding energy term can come to win over the entropy term, right? Because this depends on temperature, this doesn't, okay? So, if we plot the abundances of these species as a function of time, the behavior looks like the following. And so here I'll make a schematic plot of like log of abundances versus log of, temperature. Okay, right. But to have time go this way, I'll have temperature go that way. Okay, so early on we just have, free protons and neutrons. Okay, no helium. Eventually, though, so for temperatures of around like 0.1 MeV, the number of neutrons just falls off a cliff. Okay, and at that same time, the number of helium atoms also rises really sharply. Okay, so this is happening because at these temperatures of around 0.1 MeV. It becomes thermodynamically favorable to have helium-4 nuclei instead of free protons and neutrons, as you can verify just by plugging in to this expression. Okay, so therefore, then you might think that all of the nucleons, all of the free nucleons, all of them will be absorbed into heliums, making our universe just full of only helium and nothing else at this time. Okay. But that is not what happens, okay? So the number of neutrons goes almost to zero. The number of protons, though, does not. And why do you think that might be?
Well, if the neutrons decay or disappear, the process turns them into protons and electrons.
Right.
The number of protons should increase as the number of neutrons decrease.
So the number of neutrons is not equal to the number of protons before this time, right? So as we said, at weak freeze-out, okay, there is about five protons for every neutron. Okay, so why does that matter? That matters because helium-4 is made out of two neutrons and two protons, okay, equal numbers of neutrons and protons, okay? So if the number of neutrons had been equal to the number of protons, then all of the nucleons indeed would have been just sucked up to make helium nuclei. But however, there's not enough neutrons for every proton, okay? So instead what happens is that basically all of the neutrons get sucked up into helium nuclei. The equal number of protons also get sucked up to make those helium nuclei, but there's plenty of leftover protons, okay? So how many are made? Well, so as we said, so at weak freeze out, the number of of neutrons is like a fifth of the number of protons. However, though, weak freeze-out happens at a temperature of around like 1 MeV, okay? This helium formation happens at a lower temperature, which means a later time, okay? And this time difference, turns out to be like around minutes, okay? That matters because the free neutron decay lifetime, as we said before, is around 15 minutes, okay? And so during the time between weak freeze-out and reaching this 0.1 MeV, a fraction of the free neutrons have decayed, okay? And so we go from having n neutron over n proton from around 1/5 instead to around 1/7, okay? Just because of the free neutron decay in those few minutes between going from 1 to 0.1 MeV, okay? Okay, good. So then how many then? Okay, yeah, right. And so this is at t around 0.1 MeV. And again, okay, yeah, and again, this is just due to the free neutron decay.
Wait, sorry, I didn't catch it if you just said it. Why doesn't the number of neutrons, why didn't that, go to zero, actually?
Right, so had these sort of nuclear interactions not been taking place, okay, so instead had all the neutrons just remained free, then indeed all of them eventually would have decayed on timescales longer than 15 minutes, okay? So free neutrons decay, right? But neutrons that are bound inside of nuclei, like helium, et cetera, they don't freely decay because they, because they are stable, okay? So therefore, luckily for the neutrons, they were able to survive because these sort of fusion reactions were able to capture them and then preserve them as neutrons inside of stable nuclei, okay? Right, in the absence of these sort of fusion reactions, you're right, all the neutrons eventually would have freely decayed if they had stayed as free neutrons. Yeah. Again, because universe is very old compared to 15 minutes. Yeah. Okay. Good. So this is the number of neutrons compared to protons, and therefore then we can then work out how many heliums are produced. Okay. So the mass fraction in neutrons, okay, after weak freeze, the mass fraction is, is 1/7 over, n neutron over n plus np, okay, and is therefore 1/8. Okay, that's the mass fraction in the neutrons, all of which are then sucked up to make heliums. The same amount of numbers of protons, and therefore the same mass, is also then sucked up to make heliums. Okay, so therefore the mass fraction in heliums is therefore 1/8 plus 1/8, or about 1/4. Okay, and again these are approximates. Okay, so therefore in equilibrium at a temperature of around 0.1 mega electron volts, what we expect is a universe that has about 75%. Hydrogen nuclei, so protons, and around 25% heliums. Okay, and again, this is at around 0.1 mega electron volt temperatures. Okay, now for even lower temperatures below this, okay, so energetically, it would be favorable to make even heavier nuclei, so things like carbon, for example. Okay, right, And there's similar processes to these that can make things like carbon. Okay, so an example taking place in stars is called the triple alpha process, in which through a chain of reactions, three helium nuclei, so three of these, can turn into a single carbon nucleus. Okay, however, though, these reactions tend to be slow. Okay, the reason is that there's a strong Coulomb barrier to overcome, okay? So the Coulomb barrier gets stronger and stronger, the larger the atomic charge of each of these nuclei is. And it works out that back in the early universe, these sort of reactions are slow enough that sadly carbon never reaches its equilibrium abundance, okay? And so instead, what we're left with is basically just this leftover abundance, okay? And so the prediction of these BBN theoretical calculations is that, you know, is that today our universe should be mostly, you know, 3/4 hydrogen, 1/4 helium. And it turns out that observationally that is exactly what we see for our universe. Okay? Good. So any questions about any of this BBN? Yeah.
I have sort of an ill-defined question, but so are the only observations we've made to confirm all of this kind of theoretical backing just, you know, 75% hydrogen and 25% helium, or are there other things that kind of confirm?
So observational evidence for this, or do you mean?
For this process, I mean, it's like a very logical, like.
Oh, thank you.
Very much, but I mean, like, it very much, like, you know, comes from, you know, general chemistry and all that.
I would call it chemistry. Well, yeah, I mean, it's reasoning similar to chemical reasoning, but I guess chemists wouldn't call this chemistry. They would call this, like, nuclear reactions. But yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Fair enough, okay. But, yeah, so, like, I don't know. How do we know that there's not some other process that could give us 75% hydrogen?
Can I ask questions in another way? Like, let's say that this is for a homogeneous universe, and, like, we just have this gas only has this specific, like, reactions. What if we have, like, some density fluctuations?
Oh, yeah, fantastic.
Some other reactions, because, like, now we have, like, another energy, like,
potential, the same result.
Like, we have these reactions when we have a gas that is, like, homogeneous, and now we can talk about equilibrium of the whole gas.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you're saying, suppose that there are spatial variations in this photon to baryon number, spatial variations in, right, like the local temperature.
Okay.
That's right. And, yeah, you're exactly right. So because this stuff depends exponentially, you know, on things like the temperature, it depends so steeply on the photon to baryon number. Right, so if there were significant variations in these numbers, you're right, it would completely change the predictions of BBN. And so actually it turns out that one of the ways that we know that there's not large fluctuations in these quantities, like the mean baryon of the photon number, the local temperature, okay, you know, one of the evidences that there are not these order one fluctuations in these quantities is the fact that what we get in the actual universe matches so exactly the predictions for BBN for a homogeneous isotropic universe. That's right, okay? So had there been large fluctuations in these quantities, you're exactly right. The predictions of BBN would be quite different. It would not be consistent with what's seen. Yeah. Yeah, very good. Yeah?
Because, like, we started from, like, the nucleon numbers, and we, like, know all the decay rates and the masses of the nucleons and that to get these predictions.
Experimentally, these things are done. That's right. That's right. I mean, right. You know, I mean, right. So these things are measured from, like, laboratory, experiments here on the Earth.
Yes.
Right.
But does this mean that for dark matter to have been created, it had to have been at higher energies than when the nucleon numbers were set? Like, because if they...
Oh, must dark matter have been produced, you're saying, at a
higher temperatures? Because if it were allowed to take place during some of these processes, it would change the abundance of the elements at the end.
I think what you're asking is, suppose that dark matter were produced out of the rest of the plasma at around these times. Okay, would it have significantly changed things? Okay, good. Yeah, so let's reason through that. So dark matter, as we said, doesn't participate in these sort of, processes directly, right? So the only way that it would affect anything is by changing things like the Hubble expansion rate, changing the temperature of the plasma. Okay, and so if we produce dark matter out of the rest of the plasma, so we are removing some of the degrees of freedom, some of the density of the rest of the plasma to make dark matter, right? So how much are we doing so? At these times, right, the energy density in dark matter is what? Similar to the energy density in the rest of the plasma, or is much larger or much smaller? What do you guys think? At these times, So to remind you, okay, so today, today we have that omega dark matter is like 0.3. Omega radiation is like 10 to the minus 4. And so the time when the energy density in dark matter was similar to the energy density in radiation was therefore a redshift of around 3,000. Okay, so that's the time when there was about as much mass energy, dark matter energy density, as there was in the radiation. Okay, so earlier than this, was there more radiation or more dark matter? Right, and the reason is that
it scales. Radiation is what is a minus a to the minus 4.
Four, exactly, and the matter scales like a to the minus 3. Okay. So at this time, they're similar to each other. Today, there's much more matter than radiation. Earlier times, there's much more radiation, okay? So what redshift is this, okay? So, all right, so as I said today, the temperature is around 3 Kelvin, which is around 3 times 10 to the minus 4 electron volts, okay? So 0.1 MeV. Is at a redshift much, much before this. So therefore, at that time, the dark matter was a tiny fraction of the energy density in the radiation. And so even if we produce all the dark matter at that time, okay, the amount of the energy density that we've taken out of the radiation to make that dark matter is still a tiny fraction. Yeah, okay. But yeah, but great question. Okay, so for those of you who follow cosmology, one of the things that we hope to do is to look for species besides Standard Model particles, right? Okay, so here, all that I've done is to assume that there's only Standard Model species present contributing to the radiation density. If there were other species present at those times, okay, changing G star. At those times, it would have changed the history of BBN, okay? And so one of the ways that we know that nothing really far beyond the Standard Model was taking place at these times, again, is that the abundances that we see match the BBN predictions, okay? So one of the bounds that we have on something called the number, the number of effective relativistic degrees of freedom, one of the bounds on that comes from BBN matching what we see in our universe, okay? Had there been lots and lots of other relativistic degrees of freedom, again, we would have failed to match the abundances of helium and hydrogen that we see on the sky. Yeah, right. That being said, so there are these proposed future experiments to measure this ineffective quantity even better and better. And one of the main science objectives of that is to test whether or not, test whether or not at small levels there were additional relativistic degrees of freedom at those early times. Yeah. So all that was an aside. But yeah, right. But great questions. These are all related to things that are currently being actively researched right now. Okay. Good. So
there should be a balance between like this number of relativistic degrees of freedom and like how well we can actually like constrain the amount of fluctuations, early fluctuations.
Your question before.
I mean, like, maybe we have, like, very large
amounts. No, that's right. Yeah.
At the same time.
That's right. Okay, good. I think you're right that in principle, perhaps you could counteract having, having some additional degrees of freedom by making BBN be highly not homogeneous.
Yes.
That's true.
Like
yeah.
Having the dark matter that forms the structure very early.
Yeah, for example, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Right. Yes, and so if we imagine like plotting constraints on, some sort of parameter to describe, the inhomogeneity of BBN, and then maybe some other parameter like ineffective, this number of extra stuff besides Standard Model. I think you're right that the constraints will be somewhat degenerate. Yeah. Yeah, and then perhaps we can then think of other ways to probe either of these things. So besides BBN, we also have other ways to probe this number of effective degrees of freedom using the CMBE alone. We won't have time in this class to get into it, but from the shape of the CMBE anisotropy power spectrum, you can also constrain this number of degrees of freedom. Yeah, so since that I think will be independent of this inhomogeneous BBN, I think that this degeneracy wouldn't be an exact degeneracy. I think it'll be broken somewhat by these CMB measurements. Yeah.
So then it then goes and supports the homogeneous.
So, right. So if you think about things, you know, from like the Occam's razor viewpoint, right? Okay, right. What's that?
I hate Occam's razor. Like if we really believed in Occam's razor, we'd be like, no quantum mechanics with a
That is definitely not true.
No. Eventually you get there. But like way back when, before
we had evidence for quantum mechanics. Of course you wouldn't believe quantum mechanics before we had evidence.
Yeah. So Occam's
right?
razor says there's nothing below that. So then like now with our not a very resolved view, you know, there could be things deep down that we just really don't know yet.
That's right. Right. So, very good. Okay. So prior to 1900, okay, the likelihood of quantum mechanics based off of what we knew was low. It was not zero. I agree. It was not zero. But it was a really tiny number,
yeah.
Right? Okay. Then we got evidence. We got these, you know, mind-boggling laboratory experiments that then changed our likelihoods for assigning classical versus quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess what I'm saying is that the same thing applies here. Okay, so currently, yeah, there's a possibility that there were these enormous fluctuations in the conditions back in the early universe. There's also a possibility that we had like beyond standard model physics being important at the time of BBN. Okay, right. You know, the likelihood of those. The likelihood of both of these being true at the same time is not zero. Okay. Nevertheless, in the absence of any evidence pointing towards it, I would say the likelihood for it to be true by Occam's razor is low. Right. That's all I'm saying. Okay. And I think that, you know, scientists, we operate this way, right? You know, there's a reason why we don't consider any random crazy theory of quantum gravity. Instead, we, you know, focus on things, you know, that, you know, simple explanations for what we see around us. Yeah, that's all I'm saying.
Fair enough.
We are almost out of time. Okay, so I think that was all I want. Oh, so are there further questions about BBN before we move on? No? Okay, so then in the final couple of minutes, let me just briefly introduce something that you guys will work on during your tutorial, okay? And that's the next interesting thing that happens after weak freeze out, after BBN, okay? The next interesting thing that happens occurs quite a bit later, and that's the formation of atoms from these nuclei and the free electrons, okay? So this occurs at temperatures around 0.3 electron volts, okay? This process is called recombination. All that this means, you know, just is the process of going from free protons and free electrons to make neutral hydrogen atoms, okay? Now, you guys may recall that the binding energy for, you know, I mean, the energy required to, you know, to ionize a hydrogen atom, the binding energy of an atom, okay, you know, it's around 1 Rydberg, okay, which is around 13.6 electron volts, okay? So this is much larger than this temperature at which protons and electrons finally can combine to make neutral atoms, okay? And that should be surprising to you, right? You know, right? So, you know, naively you would think that, okay, so for temperatures large compared to this binding energy, okay, you know, so atoms cannot survive just because there are so many of these ionizing photons everywhere, okay? But at temperatures this far below the binding energy, most of your photons have, you know, have energies around like 1 eV, okay, way, way below the energy required to ionize a hydrogen atom, okay? So therefore, you would, that, you know, I mean, right, you know, so, you know, so therefore you would think that the reverse process, hydrogen atom absorbing a photon, getting ionized, that would stop, you think, okay? Therefore allowing all of the ions, all the electrons, just to make neutral atoms, okay? You would think that that would happen at a temperature closer to this energy, instead of, like, you know, a factor of 30 smaller energy, okay? Do you guys see why, do you guys see the puzzle? Okay. And so now, do you guys have any guesses for why this happens so late at such low temperatures? It's similar to what we discussed before. Any guesses? I mean, feel free to throw out even your wildest dreams, you know, beyond Occam's razor. Well, okay.
The hydrogen that was forming at that time wasn't.
Oh, sorry, say it again.
The hydrogen that was forming at that time, like the when energy was of the scale of the binding energy, it wasn't stable because like photons were too energetic to actually like maybe.
Mm-hmm.
No, photons cannot do anything.
Photons can just like knock the electrons off.
That's right, photons.
Yes.
Give it enough energy for that photon, it'll just knock off the electron. That's the process of ionization, that's right.
It's just because you can form bound states with protons and electrons. Like if you, below a certain temperature, they'll not just randomly fall apart from each other. You need some sort of energy to be inputted at some critical temperature. Like you wouldn't expect, like if I just had a gas of hydrogen, it to just separate into protons and electrons without me putting a lot of energy or giving it a very high temperature.
Well, so again, starting off early times, right, the conditions are that we have lots of free protons, electrons, lots of photons all bouncing off of each other, okay? Occasionally, a proton will find an electron, but they'll become bound to each other, radiating off a photon, okay? But early on, they can't stay that way very long because some other photon just comes and hits them and then separates them again. Okay, right, so early on, this is always just happening back and forth, and you know, the number of photons early on is so high that very few protons are in these neutral atoms, okay? At some point, that has to stop, okay? What I'm saying is that, you know, naively, you might have expected that the point at which that stops is when the temperature becomes similar to this binding energy, but instead it's like a factor of 30 lower, or whatever this ratio is, okay? Yeah.
Can we give the markings? Well, really could see where BBN happened. When did the BBN happen? And which energy BBN happened? Why is that energy so much smaller?
Right. Yeah, so Gong was saying, okay, right? So heliums were forming around 0.1 MeV, but as we said, the binding energy of helium is like way, way above that, okay? And so what was preventing all of the nucleons from making helium at around this temperature?
This eta thing.
Right, there's a huge number of photons for every baryon. So why does that matter here? Okay, so.
Even if it's very unlikely that a photon of high enough energy will hit that off, there's just so many of them that it will so often.
Good. So recall that we have a distribution function of photons, right? Okay? There's some black body spectrum, right? The typical photon energy is of order the temperature. But there is this tail of the distribution. So normally this tail at 30 E or whatever is suppressed exponentially, right? So therefore, normally wouldn't matter. However, there's just a billion photons for every single one of these atoms, okay? And so, even though this tail is some tiny fraction, just because the whole thing is like a billion large, this tail still has enough ionizing photons around, okay? Yeah. Good. Okay. So yeah. So that's like the physical intuition you should have for recombination and also for BBN. Okay. you know, the reason why things happen so late at such low temperatures is enormous entropy. Okay, the high entropy also prevents, bound states like these neutral atoms from forming instead of these more entropically favored free protons and electrons. Okay.
Can we think of this like thermodynamically it should have formed before this temperature, but chemical kinetics is avoiding that because both thermodynamics and kinetics should like allow stable.
That's right. Okay, right. You know, so in the absence. Okay, right. You know, so in the absence of, well, if all that matters just was the binding energy, okay. Yeah. You know. Right. So then. Right. So then hydrogen would have formed. Neutral hydrogen would have formed, much earlier. Right. Okay. But again, because of the large entropy in the plasma, there's the huge number of photons everywhere. But, you know, that's what favors having ionized particles for a long time over having these neutral particles. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, right. So the free energy isn't the same as the energy. That's right, yeah. Okay, good. So in your tutorial, you guys will go through the exact same line of reasoning for BBN and then apply it to the formation of these hydrogen atoms, okay? And what you hopefully will find is that if you plot, the ionized fraction, call it X, okay, as a function of temperature, okay, you know, what you should find is that at high temperatures above this 0.3 eV, the ionized fraction is almost 1. Then it transitions, and then is, you know, basically almost 0. And this temperature at which it transitions is, is around 0.3 electron volts. And so hopefully, in your calculations, you will confirm this. If not, then cosmology has big problems. No, of course, yeah. Theory is never wrong, yeah. Okay, so this 0.3 electron volts corresponds to, in Kelvin, to around 3,000 Kelvin. Okay, the temperature today is around 3 Kelvin. So therefore, the redshift at which this happened is a redshift of around 1,000 or so. Okay. So this process, recombination, as it's called. Okay. You know, so this process is really important for observational cosmology. And the reason for that is that once the baryons become electrically neutral, okay, that makes the universe almost basically transparent for these photons, okay? So early times, back when there's lots of charged particles flying around, okay, photons can't travel very far before Thomson scattering off of some electron, okay? Once the free electrons disappear, okay, the mean free path for photons to travel without scattering becomes enormous, becomes like the size of the universe, okay? So the last time that a photon was able to scatter off of an electron, the last time was somewhere around this transition. Now, what's interesting is that this transition happens so quickly. So what that means is that for most of the photons that we see, the time when they last scattered, that time is very strongly peaked around this one like snapshot in time. And so therefore, we can think of the photons that we're seeing as having been last scattered on some thin last scattering surface at some redshift of around 1,000. Now, following last scattering, what do the photons do, right? They just basically freely stream, okay? So therefore, the CMB photons that we see, they're giving us this almost like unimpeded view of the conditions in a snapshot of time at this very high redshift. And so for that reason, the CMB has been so incredibly informative for us to learn about cosmology, okay? Because it's giving us this, almost unimpeded view of conditions at a time when the universe was much younger than it is today, okay? And then similarly, for neutrinos, if we could see the cosmic neutrino background, similarly, that would also give us this unimpeded view of conditions at a much earlier time of around 1 MeV instead of 3,000 Kelvin. Okay, anyway, yeah, so hopefully you guys will verify this in your tutorial Thursday. Okay, so we're out of time, so we'll stop here.